Hello and welcome back to Supernatural. We're on a quest to make the extraordinary ordinary and unlock the greatness that lives in every human being. Thanks for joining us. Now, this is going to be an especially important conversation given the current political climate in our country and some of the events that are now unfolding around the world. In my opinion, it's never been more important to have the types of conversations that we're going to have today. So, with that, my guest today is Graham Dunn. Graham is a retired police sergeant, former Marine, SWAT officer and sniper, and author of his recent book, The Jagged Blue Line, recounting the highs and lows from his 27-year career in law enforcement. He has been a longtime instructor for the military, police, and various intelligence agencies, and he currently provides executive protection for high-profile individuals, and he trains law enforcement, security groups, and civilians nationwide through his company, Ragnar Tactical. Graham, I've had the opportunity to be a part of several of your courses this year. I've done multiple carbine classes, and I just did your active shooter response that included some combat medical. And what I love about you is you're just a humble, authentic guy. There's nothing pretentious or dogmatic about what you do. You let your experience and the way you live your life really speak for itself. And that to me is true leadership. So welcome to the show, Graham. It's great to see you.
Thanks, Sean. I'm happy to be here. I really appreciate the introduction. That's nice.
Yeah, so let's jump right into it. I wanted to ask you, in light of some of the recent events that we're seeing unfold around the world, what is most troubling to you about the times that we're living through, and how do we really come together in times like these?
Yeah, I think you need to find your own community, you know, people that you can rely on, family and friends, people that you know if things go really south, that you can rely on them, you know, you can get together with them. And you know, I mean, I borderline a little bit on the paranoid side, I think, just because of what I did for all, you know, for 30 years between military and police and a military contractor. So, you know, my biggest concerns is obviously crime, but also terrorism and major disturbances, such as, you know, if we have an outage of power for a week, or, you know, we have our food and water sources go down because if something's hacked and all of a sudden, you know, our food and water is contaminated and there's no electricity, so all the food goes bad. And, you know, these are the kind of things that, you know, trouble me at night that I don't think most people really think about. So, you know, I think we're incredibly vulnerable as a nation, and thank goodness, you know, certain parts of that is changing right now, but we are still incredibly vulnerable when it comes to the power grid and our water sources and stuff like that, and terrorism. So that's the stuff that keeps me up at night. And, you know, it's unfortunate because, I mean, we can only control our own little worlds, right? So it's like, you don't want to get too wrapped around it, because then you'll, you know, you'll spiral down and go down this path where you're upset all the time and, you know, become paranoid. But on the other hand, it is stuff that I think that if you're the protector of your family, that you need to think about.
Yeah, and we'll get into some of the preparedness aspects later on, because like you said, I think it's something that a lot of people just don't talk about. But another real hot topic in our country today is around immigration. And something people might not know about you is you're an immigrant yourself. You came here with your family from England when you were, was it 10?
Yeah. So my dad was from Ireland, and my mother, she's still around. She's English. And you know, they came the legal way. They were on a waiting list for 5 years, and I went through several interviews and physicals and stuff like that, and they eventually got the call, go now or you're gonna have to go back on the waiting list or whatever. So they just dropped everything, they quit their jobs and they came over. So it was very hard for them, and you know, I would say they went from middle class to lower class and up for in the economic status for quite a while, and then they, through hard work, they got that to the middle class. But, you know, it's one of those things that, one of the things I really respect about my parents was they always wanted to be American. So, you know, even though, you know, again, my dad was from Ireland, mother's English, they always flew an American flag up front. And the first opportunity they could to become a citizen, they went down and took the test and became citizens. They were very proud and, of being Americans. And they, you know, they always told me, hey, don't bitch and moan. This is a land of opportunity. You can be whatever you want to be here, with enough effort. And that always resonated with me. you know, that want to be part of the community and want to be part of America.
Yeah, and that's why I asked, because I've heard you talk about this before, that you really took the stance that it's a great blessing to be in this country, and it's an honor to serve and join the military, because you felt obligated to give back in a certain way. And I think you look at kind of the culture that we've grown up in, or at least I've grown up in, and there's this sense of entitlement, I think, a lack of appreciation about some of the freedoms and the liberties that we have in our country, and we forget that it's our responsibility to take that and carry it forward into future generations. So is this an attitude that you came to on your own, or is it something that your parents helped instill in you? Talk about that.
I think they instilled it in me. But, you know, I mean, they didn't say to me, hey, you know, it's your duty to serve because to pay back. I mean, that's something I kind of came up with myself, but I think they instilled that mindset in me. And, you know, so I wanted to go out in the Marine Corps right away. And then when I got out of the Marine Corps, you know, I went to police work, and I consider that a continuation of service. I really do. In fact, I was in a lot more stuff as a police officer than I ever was as a Marine, which is interesting, right? Shooting and things like that. And, you know, it's always funny to me when people see my, every once in a while, somebody will see my Marine Corps license plates, or, you know, somehow they know I'm a Marine, and they thank me for my service. And that's, I really appreciate that. It's very nice when people do that. But, you know, as a police officer, I didn't get that. And I risked my life 1,000 times more as a police officer than I did as a Marine, you know, which is interesting, right?
Right.
I guess you could say.
And I think this is a great segue into some of you and your story. You have a wealth of experience over the course of your career. So could you give us just a brief overview of where you've been and some of the experience that you've gained over the course of your career?
Yeah, so Reader's Digest version. You know, I was a peacetime Marine. And so really not too exciting there. When I got out, I needed a job, and I was looking for something. I always said I'd never be a cop because my dad was a cop from the 50s to the 70s in England. And my dad was a great guy. He really was. But he was bitter, you know, and I saw that in him, that bitterness. And I saw how he had the Dr. Jekyll, Mr. Hyde. You know, if you pissed him off, it was like you could see something glaze over, and it would just change his personality and become the biggest asshole you ever met, like in a moment. From the nicest guy. And and I always saw that in him, and I was like, you know, I knew that was a result of 20 years of police work, you know? And so I was like, yeah, I don't want to do that. But, you know, I was looking for a job, and I had a buddy who was a sheriff. And he goes, you know, we get paid decent, and, you know, it's at least something for while you figure out what you want to do with your life. So I go, okay, cool. So I took the test, I got hired. I was there for like a year and a half. And then I kind of got the bug. And so I took the test to become police officer. So I got on. And I was police work for 25 years. During police work, I spent 8 years of my career as a SWAT officer, which was awesome. That was super fun. And I spent 8 years as a full-time academy instructor, so that's all I did 40 hours a week was teach. And I loved that too, because I love to teach. And all I did was, well, I spent the majority of my time probably on firearms and self-defense stuff, but I did a lot of other topics. I mean, I taught everything from constitutional law to geography, like a really wide variety of stuff, because that's what you do as an academy instructor. They divvy out classes to everybody. And then after I retired, again, I had one of those moments, because I retired young. I was only 50, 51 when I retired. And I was like, what do I do with myself? And I had about a 6-month period there where I didn't know what to do with myself. I was like, it was a weird place to be. I'm like, I'm not a cop anymore, but what do I do? You know, I mean, I can only work out and walk the dogs and fix so much shit at the house, you know, I run out of things to do, right?
Yeah.
And my wife still works, so I was like, okay, I'm bored. So I contracted for about a year as a trainer. So I worked for an intelligence agency as a trainer. I did all their firearm stuff and all their combative stuff. And I did their medical stuff when it came to like penetrating trauma too, like gunshot wounds and other stuff. And then, you know, that contract expired. So then I went on my own. I've been teaching classes on the side for, boy, since 2003, I think is when I incorporated. And I thought, well, you know what? Maybe I'll put some money into advertising and just see how that goes. And I think it was a student actually prompted me to do that. And I mean, it blew up. Like, it was perfect timing. So it was over COVID. And COVID, I mean, panic pays well. So I had all these people wanting, classes and learn how to use a gun to defend themselves and stuff like that. So I was one of the few people who actually really profited from COVID, even though I think it's a terrible thing, obviously. It just worked out in my favor. So anyway, so I've been on my own now for like 5 years-ish. And, I teach probably on average 2 days a week, either a class or a private lesson or something like that. And the stuff I teach is all the gun stuff is level one, level two, level three handgun. And that includes permits. Level one, level two, level three carbine, precision rifle one and two, combat shotgun, pistol red dot. Those are my gun classes. And then I teach a gun jitsu class that I came up with from my life of doing jujitsu. And it's like fighting jujitsu with a gun. And then like disarms and gun retention and things like that. How to draw from really compromised positions, like if somebody's got you in the choke or whatever. And then I have an edge weapon seminar that I do. And then, as you mentioned on the side, I do protection work. So, I haven't done a whole lot lately. It's really slowed down. And part of it is I've been so busy with my training business, which is good because I'd much rather do training than protection. Protection is not what it's cracked up to be, Chad. I got to tell you, it's not like in the movies. Occasionally do something really fun and cool, but the majority of it is a lot of hurry up and wait with no room for error and a lot of attitudes, especially like the assistants' attitudes. And I mean, I've done protection details for some really very well-known people that you would all know. I mean, I could mention a couple of them, but
Can you mention any names or share anything about some of the people that you work
yeah.
with?
Well, I was with royalty for about 2 years. I'll say that. I won't tell you which one, but it's one you know really well. And then also, I worked RFK Jr. When he was running for president before he got Secret Service protection. Let's see, who else? One of the NFL owners. I'm the Colorado guy. Whenever they come to Colorado, whether the team plays here or whether they come on a ski trip or something, I'm their guy. They have a full-time guy too. Actually, we got two full-time guys, but if they come, I'm always the one. So they like to have a local when they come to town, and I'm a local for a lot of different people. So the benefit of having a local is you know the streets really well. So if you're being chased or followed or something like that, you know how to get out of that. Whereas somebody who just flew in from another city, they don't really know what they're going. You know what I mean?
Right, yeah.
So that's a benefit of having a local. Plus, if you get an address, you know exactly where it's at, especially if you're a cop. You're like a road map, right? Versus somebody who, I mean, recently one that came up, just to give you an example, was the NFL owners. Their local guy was about to take him to somewhere on the opposite end of town because he put in south. This is the address instead of north. And what he didn't understand was in the city and county of Denver and metro area, if there's no direction coordinator, like north, east, southwest, it always means north. Okay. So if it's east, you'll say east. If it's west, you'll say west. If it's south, you'll say south. If it doesn't have something, if it just says whatever street, that's always north. And he didn't understand that, and he thought it was a south address. He was literally going to take him an hour the wrong direction. You know what I mean? And with a client, stuff like that, man, that's a deal breaker. There's a couple of things you don't do with clients. One is you don't ask for a photograph, unless you want to go home, by the way. And the other is, get pulled over, like for speeding, which happened to me once. And another one would be like get lost or, be rude. I mean, those are kind of like deal killers where you pretty much might as well pack your stuff and go home. And your contract employees, so they can tell you to go home at any moment, But yeah, I did get pulled over once with a very high profile person that you would all know. And it was embarrassing. And I was speeding, and they pulled me over and made another bodyguard and then got the client in the back. And he walks up, the officer, and he recognized, my client. And it was an interesting moment. But, you just said, okay, slow down and, that kind of thing. But it's funny that, the other guy said to me after the fact, he goes, he must like you because you're still here. That's usually a deal killer, getting pulled over. So, but shit happens, right? I mean, life is life. I mean, things happen.
Right, and there, yeah, there's so much that you don't think about, especially when it comes to jobs like that, and just another reason to be prepared for all situations, be a well-rounded person. What, out of all these roles, what was the most interesting or most exciting for you, and are there any stories that really stand out from that time?
Police work, I mean, car chases were probably the most adrenaline pump, if that's what we're looking for. I was in three shootouts as a SWAT officer, and then as a protection guy, I mean, actually, it's been actually pretty low key in general. The biggest problem I have when as a protection guy is people bothering my clients when they're trying to eat. If you can imagine that. So they're sitting down there and they're literally putting a fork to their mouth and somebody comes over and taps them on the shoulder asking for a photograph. And that's, it's just rude,
Yeah,
right?
that
I
doesn't
mean,
surprise me though.
people are so clueless, right? So I have to intercept them. I'll sit like at a table, a couple of tables away, and if I see somebody moving towards them, I intercept them basically. Things like that. And that's kind of stuff, you wouldn't think about, right? An interesting one was Roger Goodell. I had him for a draft, and he likes to go out in the crowd and take photos with everybody, and they're all half drunk. I mean, they're just hammered. They serve alcohol there, and these people are just wasted, right? And he's going through the crowd, and it's funny because when he goes up on stage, everybody boos him, right? That he wants to go out and beat a man out of the people. So anyway, all these people want to come up, and they're like, "Ah," and you don't know if they're about to stab him or hug him, and they're just lit. They're totally drunk, right? So, I mean, that was a long week, man. I mean, I put my hands on a lot of people that week. And, I'm very nice to begin with. And that's just the way that you should be if you're in that role or a police officer. Unless I have to go shitty, I won't get shitty. I'll just say, excuse me, we're in a hurry. I'm sorry. Maybe later we'll get a picture, whatever. I understand, but we're in a hurry. I'm sorry. And then I kind of escalate on that. And that kind of escalates up to you need to get fucked back or you need to get hurt. So it's kind of like in an escalation order because some people just don't get it, especially when they're drunk. It's like, oh, no. And they try to push past you and things like that. And that's when I have to start escalating. But that was a long week for me, but it was a fun experience. I'd never worked a draft before. It was cool. But man, I earned my money that week. I'm talking like 16-hour days on your feet, and it's hot. I mean, you cannot let down your guard for 1 second. You're just on high alert the entire time. So that was a long week, but a cool experience though. I'm glad I did it. It was fun. Paid
Yeah,
well. Yeah.
I'm sure. Yeah, it's super interesting. What a cool experience to have. Now, something you said earlier, you were talking about your father and kind of the toll that this work takes on him. And a large part of what I do is I help people move through their inner blocks so they can start to create different results in their outer life, because we've all experienced some degree of trauma, difficulty in our lives, and when we don't process these experiences and we carry them around, it ends up showing up as all these blocks that hold us back from achieving true happiness, success, abundance, relationships. And so I think in, especially in military, police, the kind of work that you do, you see a lot of these people who end up kind of with a lot of inner darkness. They become closed off and angry and bitter at life, as you mentioned. So, how have you managed to process a lot of these things that you've experienced and been able to put the bad days behind you so you could keep moving forward?
Well, I'll start with saying that I think I'm in a pretty good place. Like, I don't think I'm one of those guys who, has to fight demons every day and every night, which is surprising because I've seen so much shit.
Yeah.
But, I think it's a matter of perspective and also your support system. So I'm fortunate that I've been with the same woman now for 29, 30 years, married for like 26, and we dated for like 3 years before that. I have three adult sons who are, in a good place. So, I've got that support, and my wife is my best friend for sure. But nobody else I'd rather go have a beer with, honestly, to this day.
That's how it should be.
Love to talk to her. She's fun. But I married up for sure. She's better looking than me, and she's fun to talk to. But anyway, the thing is that I realized something. I had an epiphany, a couple things, many, many years ago. And one was when I was in the military. So I was in a school out in Quantico, Virginia, and it was a really hard school. And the weather sucked. Like, it was fucking cold. Can I shit swear, John?
Go for it, yeah.
Sorry.
That's what I love about you. You speak your mind and you tell it like it is.
Well, if you want me to curtail things, I will. But anyway, I mean, we're all cold, wet, tired, and hungry, and pissed off. And some of the guys I'm with, I mean, they're just complaining incessantly, right? And it's really easy to get sucked into that. And there was another guy with another one of my friends, and he just made jokes constantly. Like, we'd be freezing so cold that I could barely feel my fingers. And he's cracking jokes about it, about being cold. And you just had to laugh because you're so miserable, right? And I had this epiphany. I want to hang out with him, not the other guys, because all they're going to do is drag me down mentally. And it's a mental game, right? You know, it doesn't matter how physically tough you are. It's all mental. So it's not always been about the, you know, something hard physically is not so much about being a great athlete. It's about whether you have it upstairs to be able to deal with hardness, you know? And so that has been advice I've given to my sons growing up. I'm like, separate yourselves from the negative people. I'm not saying cut them off. I mean, they could be family, they could be friends, and you like them. I get it. But I guess curtail it. You know, don't hang out with them every day. Recognize that they are negative, you know, and try to associate yourself and surround yourself by positive people. That definitely rubs off on you, without a doubt. Positivity rubs off, negativity rubs off, right? And it just makes life a lot easier if you're positive. So I try to do that. And it's not saying I'm never negative, because I am, but I try to be, you know, a lot more positive than negative. So that was one thing. Another thing I learned many years ago was I noticed that, so in my career, I probably knew like half a dozen to a dozen guys who killed themselves, right? A couple in the military, but more in police. And I noticed one thing that they all had in common, that it was their identity revolved around their job. Like, they didn't have a whole lot of outside interests. And, you know, something that's very common in police work is guys retire and then a year or two kill themselves. And I think it's because that was their identity for so many years, and now they don't know what to do with themselves. And you know, when your mind has nothing to think about, that's when all the demons come in, right? When you don't have hobbies and stuff to do, when you don't work and when you don't have hobbies, when you're just sitting around, that's when you think about all the negative shit in your life. So, you know, I made it a point early on in my career to have outside hobbies that had nothing to do with police work. And also to have outside friends, because that's another thing I noticed too. Whenever I hung around the cops, we talked cop shit. And we also talked about all the negativity of, you know, work. So, you know, this boss of ours who we all can't fucking stand, or, you know, the way the city treats us, or, you know, whatever, right? And it's so easy to get, you know, wrapped around that, right? So again, not to say I never associated with cops, because I did, and I still do, but again, I keep it in perspective. So I, you know, it's not like I'll never tell a cop story if somebody asks me or something, but it's not something I want to dominate my conversations and my identity. You know, that's not who I am. I'm much more than that, right? So, you know, have your outside hobbies, even if it just means you've got to like put your foot in the water and just try something out. Go, well, fuck, I've never played golf before. Maybe I should take some lessons and see if I like it. And if I don't like it, okay, fine. I'll do something else. But I mean, at least try something, right? And don't just be one of these guys where all I do is stuff related to military or police, right? And I knew so many of those guys. And those were the personalities that killed themselves, especially after they retired.
Yeah, that's great advice. And it's true. It really does rub off on you, the people that you spend time with, the thoughts that you surround yourself with, the media that you're consuming, the stuff you're seeing on social media. It really absorbs and becomes a part of who you are, and that really resonates kind of what you said about the complainers versus the uplifters and the encouragers. I remember being an athlete, and we weren't, you know, doing the stuff that the military guys are doing, but you're getting dragged through the mud, and in training camp you're about to go into all this testing, and there's guys who complain, and get dragged into the negativity. Oh, this sucks. I can't believe we have to do this. And there's guys who they're cracking jokes and it lightens the mood. It helps you remember that I'm not what I do. My identity is larger than anything I accomplish, my job, my sport, my career, that I'm just here for the experience and I'm going to give it everything I got. And whether I fail or succeed, at the end of the day, it's more of the effort and the willingness to do it. It's the person I became in the process that really matters. So
part of the journey, right?
Right, right.
So, you know, Bruce Kulian says, just on that point, that you are the five people you hang out with most. And I think there's a lot of truth to that.
I agree.
Yeah, but again, it's all about the journey. I mean, I didn't even say that in my book. It's one of the last sentences in the entire book. You know, forget about the destination. Enjoy the journey. Because you're never going to get there.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
I mean, I think in the context I'm talking about is for training. So I'm talking about, like, you know, whether it's martial arts or whether it's firearms training, you know, whatever training you're doing to protect yourself and your loved ones, is you're never going to be the shooter you want to be. You're never going to be the you know, the jiu-jitsu guy you want to be, whatever. I mean, there's always somebody better. There is, you know, I consider myself pretty well-rounded, but there's people who are way better in everything, you know, and you're never going to be the Jason Bourne. And, you know, that guy doesn't even exist. He doesn't. You know, that's Hollywood, right?
Right. Well, guys like you would probably be the closest thing. Like, that's who these intelligence agencies hire, right? Is people like you.
And you know, that's actually interesting because, you know, intelligence agencies, when you're looking at people who actually do spycraft, for lack of a better word, they're not like badasses. They're very smart people who can play roles and get information and stuff like that. And they have basic training in like how to operate a handgun and stuff, but they're not like, you know, shooters, and they're not like martial arts guys. For the stuff that, you know, the intelligence wants that kind of thing done, they're hiring people to do that. They're hiring people, you know, with backgrounds, you know, former SF guys, SWAT guys, stuff like that, guys who, you know, are proven that they can handle themselves. And those are the guys that are having doing that kind of stuff. You know, they're not doing anything intelligence-wise other than maybe like reconnaissance and things like that. They do things like that, but they're not out there, you know, building assets and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so, yeah, we've touched upon kind of being able to surround ourselves with the right people, process and move through the things that happen to us. But at the same time, you don't want to avoid hard things and live this cushy life to avoid trauma and doing damage to yourself. I think life's about getting out, getting dirty, seeing what you're capable of. So what's the importance of adversity and experiencing hard things in your view?
Yeah, I think it's incredibly important. I think, you know, that if you get things handed to you, obviously you're not going to appreciate them. And, you know, adversity will only make you stronger. So, you know, I've kind of gone through some severe adversity in my life in different ways. And I think every single time it's made me a better person. It's never like it's weakened me or sent me down a rabbit hole. And, you know, not to say that, you know, I might not be upset for a while or depressed. I mean, those are normal human reactions to adversity. But, the you know, it's getting knocked out, but not knocked down, but not staying down, getting up, you know, and jumping back on the horse, so to speak, when you fall off the horse, right? So, you know, I also believe that, you know, you can work on mental toughness. So, you know, if you wanted to, say, go into, you know, the SEAL teams, and you, first of all, you need to be a good swimmer. But secondly, you should probably start working on ice bouts, you know, and get yourself ready for that, right? For that mental part of it. So, you know, whatever you're going to do in life, you know, like I had a fear of heights. So I went out and intentionally overcame that fear of heights. So I don't like having fears. You know, it's one of those things that if I have a fear or I'm not very good at something, I want to get better at it, which is a good quality to have as a human, right? So that's one thing that I was somehow born with. It's just who I am. And if I see a hole in my game, like something I'm not very good at, I want to get better at it. And if it means I need to train on that all the time, or if somehow, I need to go to school or get a trainer or something like that. So, I really work on being the complete package, when it comes to self-defense, with my body, with my brain, with my tools. Tools would be like, firearms, obviously, but also other tools, like less lethal tools, like a pepper spray, even just knowing what you can do with it, what you can't do, what it's good for, what it's not. A baton, things like that, right? So other tools, weapons of opportunity around you. I do self-defense seminars occasionally, usually like women's groups. I always talk about weapons of opportunity. They're everywhere. It doesn't have to be a knife stick gun. It could be, I love fire extinguishers, for example. They're great. With a fire extinguisher, not only is it a really heavy instrument to beat somebody over the head with, but you can dominate like a hallway or a cabin in a airplane with a, if you set off a fire extinguisher. So, for example, if you were in a, an office building there's an active shooter in there, you could cover your exfiltration by just setting that thing off in the hallway. So, they have other uses other than just hitting somebody over the head with coffee pots, those big metal water things that everybody carries around with it, water in it. Those are great weapons of opportunity. I always carry one of those on when I fly. And it's for one reason. It's not because I'm drinking my water out of it. It's so that I can use it if I had to, if some idiot is trying to take over the plane or creating a disturbance or something like that. So, I mean, for some people they might use it as an impact weapon. For me, I'm going to use it to close a gap. So in other words, if we're looking down an aisle, if you can visualize an aisle on an airplane, I'm going to use that thing as a spiral football in his face. Whether I hit him or not with it, even if I don't, what's the natural human reaction when somebody throws something big and heavy at your face? Everybody does that.
Right,
I don't
yeah.
care if you're a ninth degree ninja, that's your reaction, right? Just put your hands up and look away, maybe something like that. That gives me valuable time to close the distance so then I can do what I know what to do, right?
Yeah, and
So.
a lot of that goes back to situational awareness, and so often we're glued to our phones or thinking about something else, minds preoccupied. So it's really about pulling ourselves back into the moment, being where we are right here, right now, and having the frame of mind to be prepared for whatever might happen
100%.
in today's world.
Yeah.
Now, I'm a lot like you too in these areas. I enjoy pushing the envelope of performance, and I just want to see what I'm capable of, what I can become. But I'm also aware this is a very small minority of the population, I would say. One of the biggest areas in my line of work is that you can't force people to change. You can't muster up the motivation for them, and which I think for a lot of us is hard because we truly want to help people. So, what's your experience been with that? Is motivation something that needs to be intrinsic, or is there some way we can extract this out of people?
Yeah, I mean, I think you're right. I mean, people have to want to do it, right? I mean, it's like anything in life. If they don't want to do it, they're not going to do it. It doesn't matter the best trainer or the best motivational speech. But I mean, I do think it helps motivating people. Being a good role model to people and motivating people, and they see what you're doing, no matter what it is in life, finances, martial arts, whatever it is, if you're a good role model, probably some of the best compliments I've ever gotten is people telling me, I lost 20 pounds because you motivated me to get in shape. I wanted to be in better physical condition, something like that. To me, those are really heartfelt compliments, and I'm like, man, that's so cool that somebody looked at me and listened to me in a class or whatever, and they go, I want to lose weight and be, a better person, that kind of thing, or be a better shooter or whatever it is they want to be. It'd be really cool to say somebody hear somebody say, I want to be a better dad because of you, something like that, right? So, I mean, I think we do impact people whether we realize it or not, just by the way we act. But being positive, that kind of thing. So, but I mean, to your point, people are who they are, and you can't for sure change people. They have to want to change. There has to be something in them to want to change, right?
Right.
So, there's an old expression in the training world that there's no such thing as bad students, only bad instructors who have failed to motivate their students. And I would say that, I kind of disagree. I think there are people who, I don't know if I use the word bad, but unmotivated. Like they just don't want to learn.
No, I think I agree with you. Yeah.
And it's cool, but in my business, when I'm teaching classes, the people are paying to be there, so they want to be there. So I don't have to deal with that, right? Because they're all wanting to learn, which is great. I love students who are earnest because they just want to soak it in and learn what you want to have. And where I've experienced that is, when I was a full-time academy guy for 8 years, with the recruit classes, we get recruit classes as big as 45 people. We'd have them for 6 months. And they were generally really earnest. Like they wanted to be there and learn, and they're excited about their new job and everything, right? And those were fun to teach. The ones that were harder were the old guys. So we do in-service training. They get 40 hours a year, like one 10-hour day a quarter, and they come in, and some of them just didn't want to be there. You could just see it on their face. They're like, looking at their watch, and they didn't even ask you, are we gonna get out early today? I mean, that's the hardest person to deal with. So, over the years, I kind of came up more in dealing with those people, though, where I got at least the best out of them. So, I've been doing this for a while now. July is 26 years as a Grimes instructor, and I've been teaching martial arts for longer than that, like probably 4 or 5 years longer than that. So here's the thing is that, when I have a class like that, I just tell them, hey, man, here's the deal. If we fuck around, you'll be here till 5 o'clock because that's what we're scheduled to. If you guys work hard and I can see you working hard, I'm going to get you out early. How's that? And that usually works with people. They're like, okay. And they'd like actually get it done, right? Versus, when they're just thinking, oh, this is bullshit. I've just got to get through this day. So, and if somebody really has that bad of an attitude, I'd be like, hey, man, do you not want to be here? Do you want to just take the day off? And you can just tell your supervisor that you can reschedule. How's that? I just get to the point where I get tired of dealing with attitudes like that. I'm like, I'm giving you my time trying to help you out here. So, if it's really that big of an imposition to you. But I never understood that because to me, when you're a police officer, your job is to protect yourself and other people. So you should try to be the best person you can be.
Exactly.
So, physically and mentally. And, I worked with, look, I'll go back a little bit here and say that the overwhelming majority of people I worked with, and I worked with thousands of cops in my career, were awesome people. But it is your regular bell curve. So you've got 20% who are like studs, high performers. And I'm not just saying like SWAT guys, I'm talking about like say a detective. And this detective may not be in the greatest shape. They might be kind of overweight or whatever, but they're really good at what they do. Kind of the Columbo, right? And then you've got your 60% in the middle of that bell curve who are average employees who have their shining moments. They do really well at certain things sometimes, but they're not superstars. And then on the bottom, you get your 20% who are kind of turds. And when I say turds, I don't mean like they're bad people going out committing crimes. Not to say that that hasn't happened, it doesn't happen, but they're just lazy or don't care, and it's just a paycheck, and maybe they're rude and things like that, right? And that bottom 20%, like in any profession, is going to give you all a bad name, right? Those are the ones with the same ones that train, though, that I had to deal with. And trying to motivate them sometimes was, like pushing a chain, right? So it's like, I just got to the point where I was sick of dealing with those people. And I'm like, you know what? If you don't get here, you can leave.
Yeah.
So, it's kind of on a sidetrack conversation, but, like you said, though, it's kind of back to your point. You can lead a horse to water, but you can't make a drink.
Yeah. I do like how you talked about finding little things to move people forward. Because everybody's motivated by something, right? And you just got to figure out what that is. And I think the more you're in a profession that you're in, working with people, getting to know them, you start to see this pretty easily. What's motivating people, how to push their buttons. And I really love your point too about how we actually are impacting people, whether we know it or not, just by how we're living our lives. People are looking at us, and I can look at a guy like you and say, he's well-rounded in all these different areas, great dad, great, obviously great shooter, great entrepreneur, all these different areas. And if I see that in you, it's going to activate something in me. And so I think that's what I tell people, is that just be the example yourself, and you'll change more people than you know. And so this is your biggest focus today, is in training people. You do law enforcement, private security groups, civilians, and as you mentioned, you're doing all kinds of stuff, from firearms to edge weapons and penetrating trauma, active shooter. And I think there's still a large swath of people out there who are in the frame of mind that, who needs this? You know, I'll just call the cops, or I'm just going to pray that this never happens to me. But for me, part of being a good citizen for ourselves and the people around us is having that skill set, being capable of those things, and being prepared for any situation that might arise. So what do you tell people when it comes to this? Why is it important that we as citizens have this kind of training?
Yeah, well, you just can't expect the police to be there all the time, right? And, you know, sometimes I even fall back on stats. So, you know, the Department of Justice tells us that the average active shooter scenario is over in 2 minutes, with an average of 8 people dead. So I would argue that even if a police officer just happens to be sitting in the parking lot across the street, typing the report in his car, by the time he gets a call, drives across the street and runs in, 2 minutes is already gone. You know, there's actually quite a delay when you call. And this is no knock on dispatch or anything else. It's just reality. But when you make a call, it goes to a call taker who sends it to a dispatcher, who sends it to a police officer. That process in itself takes about 2 minutes. And let's say that, you know, they just happen to be doing nothing at the time. It's a slow day. And again, you just happen to have a guy sitting across the street typing the report in his car. He pulled over to type the report, and he just happens to be a walk away. And that comes out and he goes, oh, crap, that's across the street. And he runs over. You're still looking at over 2 minutes. You know, he's going to be, the smoke's going to be clearing by the time he gets in there. It's probably going to be done. You know, so that's why so many of these are done before the police get there. You know, so I think you need to be ready, you know, to protect yourself. You just can't assume that other people are going to do it for you, right? And then upon that, I mean, you know, we're just facing such challenges right now with terrorism and everything else. You know, intelligence analysts tell us that October 7th in Israel was a warm-up to the United States, and that over the last 4 years before this year, roughly 1,000 Al-Qaeda terrorists, well-trained, made their way into the United States. And they're just floating around here, just waiting for the right moment. And they'll be coordinating attacks like there was in Israel. So interestingly, I mean, these people are not stupid. Their targets are going to be where there's a lot of people and where they believe people are not going to be armed.
Yep.
Right? They don't want fight back. So, you know, the thing is that if you look at what happened in Israel, they go into neighborhoods, they've got very strict gun control laws. So nobody owns a gun other than military and police. So they're just going house to house doing whatever they want. Raping, murdering children, beheading babies. You know, crazy shit, right? And they're putting it on live stream. So here's the thing. You do that in a downtown area where it's predominantly people who don't like guns. They know that. They're going to get a lot more bang for their buck. The police are going to be totally overwhelmed. I don't think people realize how very few police are out there at any given time. You know, I mean, there's like one officer assigned to every several square miles. You know, like 5 square miles has one officer assigned to it. And they're busy constantly taking reports or pulling people over, doing whatever they do, right? So if you ever look, go to a large police department and look at their beat map. They'll have a map like on the wall with the beats in there, like how many beats. So for example, you know, in my city, I know there's like 23, 24 beats between the different districts. And it's a huge city, right? And there's one car assigned to each beat. That's it. You know, so if you take out like detectives and maybe some specialized units like SWAT or gangs or whatever it is, narcotics, I mean, actual beat cops, they're even in a huge city, there might only be worked like 20, 30 of them working at any given time. So, you know, if they get 5 terrorists going to the nearest mall and the nearest church and the nearest school all at the same time with ARs, they're going to have a really hard time. They're going to be completely overwhelmed. So, you know, the thing is they're going to avoid rural environments, A, because they know that they're not going to get this high body count, but B, because they know people armed. They know people out there own guns and they'll fight back. So their chances are much less than going to somewhere where people hate guns, right? I mean, it's pretty obvious stuff.
Yeah, and you were in Aurora. Are you comfortable saying that? I know you don't
Yeah,
share
it's fine.
that in your
Yeah, it's fine.
book,
No, it's
but
fine.
you were in Aurora when we had the Century 16 shooting at the
Yeah.
movie theater, correct? How
Yeah.
did
So,
that really change people's views of
yeah.
what really goes on during
And
attacks like
I'll talk about
that?
Section 16, but let me just touch on the book for a second. So, the reason why I didn't put anything in the book about names, places, dates was just for slander purposes. So, I don't even mention the city I worked in. Now, obviously, well, here's part of the reason why. I mean, there's a couple of times where I bring up stories involving some of our leadership. And here's the thing is when I had an attorney read it, he goes, they could sue you over that. I don't know if they'd win or not, but they could sue you because it's true, but they could sue you. And do you want to go through the hassle? And I thought about it, so I took the names and I took out anything, even the name of the city. Thing is it's actually a pretty high standard for slander. Like if they read it and go, man, he's talking about me, and they will, for sure. That's not enough. They have to prove that other people know and also that they suffer a loss, either to their character or to financially or something like that. So it's pretty high standard. But I'm not rich. I don't want to go through, a big financial battle. And that's part of the reason why I've never written a book about my bodyguarding, because I could write a book on bodyguarding, like all the crazy stories I've done with people.
I
But
bet.
I've signed all these non-disclosure agreements, and those people have a lot more money than I do. So I don't want to get dragged into, court and go broke. But anyway, back to Century 16. So with Century 16, I wasn't there when it went down. I was working a day shift and I woke up like 5 o'clock in the morning and turned on the TV. I'm getting ready. I'm gonna head to the gym like I always did before I went to work. And I saw it and I was like, holy shit, that's here in Aurora. So I just jumped up in my uniform and I headed straight to work. And I ended up being there for 18 hours though. So I was there over the day. I was a road supervisor at the time, and I was there over the day, like handling the crime scene and interviews of witnesses and evidence collection and stuff like that. So, they had people doing all that. I was just kind of like the puppet master, along with a couple of the supervisors. Because people don't realize what a huge endeavor something like that is. But nonetheless, I was there for 18 hours, and I mean, it was a crazy experience to go through that and see how that affected people and all the lessons that I learned from that. It's one of those things that if you did it a second time, you'd do it way better. It's like anything in life, But I think actually we did an amazing job, we meaning the department, on that, especially the guys who were there when it first went down, a couple of guys in particular. Who really did an amazing job, whether it was treating people who needed medical attention. One of my buddies who was a leader there, and he does speaking engagements on it now. But he was a lieutenant, and he actually was like in charge. And it's interesting, if you go to YouTube, you can find like dispatch tapes, and there's no real video to it. It's just people collecting it off the internet, right? And you hear people like really like kind of losing their shit on the radio. And my buddy is very calm and cool, collected. He's basically the calm in the storm, man. And it's kind of like one of those things where I don't know if you've ever seen the movie Any Given Sunday with Al Pacino and
I haven't, no.
Jamie Foxx. It's an excellent movie. It's a lot of fun. But it's anyway, it's about, pro football. And at one point, Al Pacino says to Jamie Foxx, something to the effect of, you're the quarterback. And when everything's going bad, people are looking for somebody to believe in. And if you're that, you're calm and steady, they're going to be calm and steady. If you're a mess, they're going to be a mess. So anyway, he was that guy, and I give him tons of credit for that. So anyway, he's one of the few people I actually mentioned in my book. I only mentioned two people by name, one of whom was a friend of mine who's deceased. And another one is it's Jad, and because it's a positive thing. So, but anything negative, I didn't mention that. Now, the book isn't full of negativity, but there is a few negative things in there.
Yeah.
I'm not, you know me, Jad. I mean, you've been to my classes. I don't hold back. So I call things what they are. And there were some people who fucked things up dramatically and made some humongous mistakes, mostly in leadership. And so I call them up for it. I tell their stories. I just didn't leave them. I just took out their names. But if they read it, they know who I'm talking about.
That's
That's
fair.
for sure. And you know what? They have to have that on their conscience,
Oh,
that they
yeah.
know that this is how the average truth of work can be felt.
Yeah, and that's important, I think, is, get the truth out there. And kind of back to your point on Century 16 and everything went down, I think that we do overlook all the good that happened. We tend to focus on the negative. The media focuses on all the things that went wrong or on the killers, but we look past the dozens or hundreds of people, men and women in uniform or even civilians on the scene who did really brave and heroic things and who took the situation, something that was really, really awful, and made it better than the outcome could have been. So.
Yeah, I mean, I could talk for hours about stories from Century 16 about, the guys who just did such amazing things there, as far as giving medical treatment and evacuating people and just all the things that they did. I mean, it was so it's interesting stuff. But if you ever look it up, it's public record. There's an after-action report. It's like 50 pages long on the Century 16. And I really think it was the shining moment in Aurora PD's history, where they did really, really well as a group. And it was interesting for about maybe a month. I'd be on patrol, I'd be in uniform, and I'd have people come up and thank me. And sometimes people you wouldn't imagine. Like the kind of guy you are. I'll give you an example. I had a guy come up to me, tattoos all over his face, and he looks like a hardcore gangster. And very sincerely thanked me for, really sincerely, thank you for that, blah, blah, blah. And I was really taken aback. I mean, when he first walked up to me, I thought he was going to give me a hard time about something. I just did not expect it. And that was an interesting time. But on the other hand, it didn't last long. After about a month, it went away. And we went back to, I'm driving down the street and people are giving me the finger. But we had about a month of reprieve.
Yeah. Tragedy and hardship, it really does. It has a weird way of bringing people together and giving people perspective, I think. And something that you've touched upon in this conversation already is the concern of things like increased terror attacks, especially with what's unfolded in the past week or two in the Middle East. There's a real concern about sleeper cells here in the US, even false flags that get blamed on one side or the other to draw US into a war. You can talk about, you did talk about the power grids and how delicate that is, that we may need to survive for days or even weeks if we had an attack on our power grid from inside or outside of the country. And so I wanted to get some of your thoughts on overall preparedness, because I think there's a lot of people who maybe they're aware of the possibility, but they're in a place where it's like, I can't be spending thousands of dollars preparing and buying ham radios and solar powered generators. So what do you tell the average citizen when it comes to being ready for anything that might happen and being able to survive for an extended period of time?
Yeah, so I'm not a big guy for collecting stuff. I probably have a week's worth of food and a week's worth of water for me and the family if I had to. I'm not saying there's anything wrong with that. If you were able to store up enough stuff to last you for months, good for you. I don't have the room for it, and I don't think I really have the motivation to do it, quite frankly. But I do keep maybe a week's worth of food and water. And also other things like trash bags. You think about what if there's no trash service? And the whole street is covered with people's trash, after a week. But toilet paper, wet wipes, crap like that, that's stuff. And I'm not saying go to Sam's Club and just load up your truck with wet wipes, but maybe get an extra couple every time you go. Every time you go to the grocery store, get an extra 4 or 5 cans of beans and just put them in. Like, those things will last forever, right? You just throw them in the closet, in the pantry. Pretty soon, you've got like 100 cans of vegetables and stuff like that that if you had to, you could live off that stuff, right? So, I mean, It is what it is as far as the preparation stuff. And I'm going to sound a bit, psycho when I say this, but here goes. I've looked at it this way. If it goes on longer than a week, I'm going to take what I need.
And I think if it goes longer than a week, there's going to be a lot of people who are in a really bad spot. And at that
Yeah.
point, everything's up for grabs anyways, so.
All three of my sons are well trained with a firearm. They're all adults. I've got enough ARs for all of us. We're going to go and take what we need if we have to. And, I'm all about trades too. If you can give me water or whatever, for I'll give you something in return, that protection or whatever. But, I mean, when it really comes down to it, your family is what you're going to look after, right? And I'm just being honest about that. But, it's funny to me, like during COVID and during, the George Floyd unrest and stuff like that, I have these people texting me who they've never thought about owning a gun. There's some do-gooder liberal type, but they know I'm a gun guy and they know I'm a training guy. So they text me and go, "Hey, do you have a gun I could borrow just for a little while?" That kind of thing. I had probably half a dozen texts like that over that time period. And I'm like, "No, I don't. You should go get one."
Yeah.
I mean, it's just crazy to me that, like, oh, that's your response to that, is to think of me and to go, "Well, maybe he'll lend me one of his guns." You know what I mean?
Right.
Yeah, I mean, and it's also the guy who has an immense amount of guns but doesn't pay for training. That's another one I deal with, right? I mean, I met a guy recently who has 14 ARs, which is more than I have, and some of them, which he's never trained, never shot even, and he's never gone through a formal training class. And I'm like, okay, I'd rather have one AR and good training than 14 ARs and not know what the hell I'm doing.
Yeah, how many do you need, really?
So, I mean, exactly. I have enough for, me and the family and the neighbors, but I mean, I don't have like this huge collection, something like that. I mean, most of my guns I have because I use them for teaching classes, or, I rent them out because I do have rental guns and stuff like that. So they have a purpose. I have my hunting guns too, but I don't like buy guns just to buy guns. That's not me. I'm not like when, I mean, okay, I'm a gun guy, I get it, but I'm not like the kind of guy who like, gets excited over a new gun and wants to shoot it, wants to own one kind of thing. I mean, for me, they're a tool. It's like if I'm, in construction, I have a fucking toolbox with screwdrivers and hammers and shit. That, to me, it's the same thing. I'm not like in love with them. I never have been.
Yeah, I'm not a fan of accumulating excess stuff either. I got what I need for me and maybe a couple other people, but it's like the intangibles, the training, the skills, the know-how is as important as the food and the water. And I think a lot of it is goes back to the first point you brought up is have community. Build a community of like-minded people, people that you trust. That are going to have your back, get to know your neighbors. Maybe you've got one thing and they've got something you don't have. And if things get really tough, you come together with those people and you kind of combine forces and you share and distribute goods and you survive as a community. And so.
One of my neighbors, who's also one of my best buddies, we hunt together and we butcher our stuff together. And you know what? I mean, if we absolutely had to, there's enough deer walking around here. I could take a deer and butcher it and feed the entire street for a week. I
Yeah.
mean, there's a lot of food there. So having the knowledge of how to butcher an animal is great knowledge to have, right? And really, my buddy is way better than me with it. I just kind of help him out. He's the lead on that. He learned by watching YouTubes. YouTube University, right?
That's right.
So, I mean, there's so much you can do, but I mean, I do think that you should at least have a short-term amount of food and water, like, 3 days to a week in minimum.
Yeah, you could go over the top with it, but I think be practical, be pragmatic, don't overdo it, but also be prepared because anything can happen at this time. Now, we're gonna start to wrap up here, but something I wanted to get your thoughts on is unfortunately, there's been this sentiment in recent years, this anti-law enforcement, anti-authority. We've had things like civil unrest and BLM and the recent anti-ICE, and you can just go on and on. But it's been very divisive, and I would imagine it's taken an extreme toll on law enforcement and their families. I've always been one who chose to believe that the people who get into law enforcement are people who truly want to do good and serve their communities, keep people safe. And of course, you're going to have some bad apples, just like any other profession, just like we have bad doctors or bad priests. But I really do believe that the people in this profession are incredible men and women who don't get enough credit. So what is it that you wish people understood about law enforcement officers, and what's it going to take to move past what we're seeing in our country?
Well, I wish that just that they gave them the respect that they deserve, and you know, understood really what they go through. Because I think that the misunderstanding is from several points. One is the only time people encounter police is in a negative way. That's just the nature of the business. And it might be you're a victim of a crime. It might be you're getting a speeding ticket, something like that. You know, traffic's an interesting one, right? Because most people, unless they're a victim of a burglary or robbery or something, an assault, the only time they bump into a cop is every 5 years when they get a ticket or something, or every 10 years when they get a ticket, you know, depending on how bad they drive, right? So that's their interpretation of what police do, right? Now, I once saw a breakdown of, and it was of Aurora, it wasn't like a nationwide thing, of what they broke down of what the tasks that patrol officers had done. And traffic stops made up 3%. Of what they do on a given day. So it's a very small part of it, but if you are a regular citizen, doesn't commit crimes and lives in a decent neighborhood, you'll probably never meet one unless you get pulled over. So that's, you think it's 90%, you know what I mean? But it's really 3%. I also think that, you know, the media and the movie industry does us no good. I think that, you know, they really go out of their way to give us a shit impression. And, you know, so people are just really, I think, ignorant to what a police officer does day to day and what they go through and everything else. And, you know, they don't give them a whole lot of slack for being a human being either. So, you know, an interesting study came out, and you can look it up. It was by the Skeptic Research Center. And it came out right after the George Floyd unrest, civil unrest, right? And the question was that they posed to the survey was how many unarmed black men, or black people, I think it was, do you think the police in the United States kill every year, right? And the choices were like 100 or less, 100 to 1,000, 1,000 to 10,000, 10,000 more, whatever like that, right? And interestingly, they also asked, what are your news sources? Like, was it something on the left, like CBS, NBC, CNN, MSNBC? Was it something on the right, like Fox or Newsmax, right? Interestingly, the average answer for people on the right was like 100 a year. People on the left, it was 1 to 10,000 a year.
Really?
Right? Wow. Yeah. Who basically get their news sources from the left. So here's what it actually was.
I'm going to guess, I'm not familiar with this, but I'm going to say that we hear about almost every single one through media sources like CNN. So it's probably very, very low.
Yeah, so what it was, so they did the year of George Floyd. Like, I can't remember if it was the year before or like the year leading up, like 365 days, but it was a year, right then, like 2019 and 2020-ish, whenever that was. And it was 13. And of the 13, like 11 of them had other things going on, like the guy was trying to take the officer's gun off him, or they're trying to run them over in a car or something like that. They weren't armed, but there was a reason why they got shot, right? There was two that were questionable. And in both those cases, the officer was charged. So, you know, and if you look also at statistics, a big elephant in the room that everybody's scared to talk about, because, I mean, quite frankly, in this day and age, one of the worst things that somebody can call you is a racist.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, it's up there with child molester. And so everybody's very scared, you know, being called a racist, right? So, you know, the big elephant in the room is when it comes to that particular thing, you know, police killing out black people. The stat is that a black man has 30 times more likely of being killed by another black person than by police in the United States, 30 times. But nobody talks about that, and that's not a concern, and that should be a huge concern. You know, that should be something where we look and go, okay, what's going on culturally that's happened, right? You know, and I think it comes back to absent fathers. You know, that's like the one thing that they find a man in prison is that they don't have a father figure, right? They don't have some guy when they screw up going home and their dad whoops their ass, which is what happened to me, right? So without that, men kind of run crazy, right? So here's an interesting one for you. There was a national park in South Africa, and they were getting overpopulated with elephants. And these elephants were just like taking all the food and everything, right? So they go, okay, we're going to move a bunch of these elephants to this other national park to kind of divvy up the population, which is makes sense. So they go, okay, at first, they're going to take them by helicopter. What they do is they like shoot a tranquilizer in them, they take them up to the helicopter, transport, and they take them over to this other park, like 10 miles away, whatever, and they drop them, right? And at first, they didn't have a huge helicopter. It was only rated to carry a certain amount of weight. So they took all the women elephants and the young male elephants first, or young male and young female, both, right? But everything but the big, they left the big male elephants because they were just too freaking heavy. They needed like a bigger chopper, right? So they moved them all over there. And while they're doing this takes some time. All of a sudden, they're finding these animals just like destroyed. And they're thinking they've got like a predator problem or something like that, right? And what it is like rhinos and hippos are just like, they're finding them just torn to pieces. And what they found was the young male elephants, without the old male elephants there. So all there is the female elephants, adults, and young male and young female elephants. And young male elephants were getting in packs and attacking randomly like these other animals, like hippopotamuses and rhinos, and just stomping them to death and just beating the living hell out of them until they died, right? And just tearing them apart. So in other words, when they finally brought over the male elephants, it stopped. The adult males. So it's kind of like humans. And we are animals, whether we choose to, you know, admit it or not, right? It's kind of like if you have a society with no strong adult males, the young males, they'll get in packs and they'll go do whatever they want to do, raping and pillaging, right? It's fascinating to me that that's how, you know, we work as psyche. But humans, in that respect, are just like animals. And it's been proven that young men who don't have father figures, they do what the hell they please. Now, I'd say that some of them don't grow up to be awesome people. I'm not saying that. But I'm just saying, as a generality, you can see, you know, a consistency there, so to speak.
Yeah, I agree with you. I think we do, especially as developing human beings, we need that balance of the male and female, the masculine and feminine energies in our lives. Right. And you see today there's an attempt to kind of suppress and demonize the masculine role of the protector and the defender. And right. I think we can't lose that as a society.
Yeah, we need it. We need it. You know, I mean, they call it toxic masculinity. Yeah. You know what? Toxic masculinity is a guy who's a dick, who's somebody who abuses people, who is a criminal. Just like a toxic femininity would be a female who does the same sort of things, right? But what we need to understand is that hormonally, men are generally the violent ones. I mean, 90% of violent crime is male, right? And I think that's a hormonal thing more than it is a cultural thing, without a doubt. You know, it's just the way that we are, you know, wired. So, and it's interesting, you know, that same line of thinking when you're talking about women who grow up without men. Many of them grow up to be awesome people, but there is also a consistency that where many of them grow up to be manipulative and over-dependent on men. So like they choose really poor male, you know, partners in life. You know, I mean, I, to make a joke of it, a lot of them end up riding the pole.
Yeah.
So it's kind of like, you know, it has different effects on young men and young women being in a fatherless home with no male role models. So it's very sad, and I wish there was a way that we could work on that. I think that's the biggest thing affecting our society right now in lots of ways, not just crime, but, you know, economically, is lack of good male role models and lack of guys you know, stepping up and being a real father. Mm-hmm. You know, rather than just impregnating, actually raising your kids and being a good role model for those kids. It's so important, you know. So again, not to say that being a good mother isn't as important, if not more important.
Right. No.
So, you know, I don't want people to take me wrong. I'm just saying it is a necessary component in a young man, young woman's life.
Absolutely.
Both the masculine and feminine role models, you know, that kind of thing, right?
100%. Yeah. And to go back to the point you made earlier about sort of the depiction in media and entertainment of people in law enforcement and other groups as well. I think what people need to recognize is there is a larger agenda to divide people, that there are very influential powers in this world that profit off of the cluelessness of the people, and they operate from the shadows. You never see their faces. They're more powerful than any head of state you see on TV. They're above politics. They transcend national borders. And they control the world through the banking system. They profit off of war. And what they understand best is that if you keep people locked in a state of fear and survival, if you make them afraid.
And ignorance.
Make them afraid of people who are different than them. People get so distracted by their differences, nobody is the wiser to the fact that they're being manipulated by an invisible hand to who's pulling the strings from behind the curtain. And it's really brilliant if you think about it. And this is why they feed us fear and negativity through the news, through the media, advertising, politics, religion. No matter where you look, there's always an enemy.
It's the oligarchy.
Yeah, right.
There's the elites.
Always somebody that we're meant to be fighting against, whether it's Russia or Islam or the feds or my own family who might kill me with a virus, right? The goal is just to divide people and get everybody locked into exactly this us versus them mentality. And people get so triggered and so blinded by their own emotional response that they don't realize they're being played. They're just a pawn on somebody else's chessboard. So I think we need to wake up and see that the real virus here is fear, that if we're busy picking sides and wishing destruction on any group of human beings, we've been suckered. We're the ones who are stuck in the matrix because we've divided ourselves from our own brothers and sisters. And I think this is what people need to see, is disengage from the news, disengage from the negativity. It's time for us to come together, that we can choose to see the goodness in other people and learn to trust one another and overcome our differences. Even if we don't agree on everything, what's really gonna bring people together is the realization that we're in this together as a human race. And at the end of the day, we're not all that different from one another. We all want the same thing at the end of the day.
I think that's incredibly well said, Chad.
Yeah, we're all after love and safety and purpose and belonging.
Yeah, we just want our kids to be safe and grow up and have a good life. And I think we all have that in common, you know? I mean, not to say there's any evil people out there, because there are, but yeah. I mean, I think part of our problem too is that we have it so good, we have to come up with things to be pissed off about.
Yeah.
Quite frankly, I mean, if you've never been to another country where you see the evil shit that goes on, you know, I mean, Middle East, I mean, child rape is nothing. It's accepted and it's every day. You know, I mean, 10-year-old, 11-year-old, 12-year-old boys and girls are raped constantly in harems and nobody gives a shit. That's just the way it is. You know, if you haven't seen true evil, like the torture chambers in Iraq, for example, I mean, where they are hanging people on hooks and fucking pulling out their gold teeth with pliers while with no anesthesia before they, you know, throw them in a box and stab them and stuff like that. I mean, this is actual shit that I know of. This is stuff like where you go, oh, we don't realize how good we have it here unless you've seen how the rest of the world operates. And people get, you know, they fixate on tiny little things that in the grand scheme of things are not big, or they may be big, but they're, you know, so if you take, like, for example, let's say you take a use of force thing and that gets on the media where a cop beats somebody up and he shouldn't have, right? I mean, is that right? No, absolutely not. I'm not saying that. But I'm just saying, if you look at the whole, we have a very peaceful society and we have a very well-trained police department. things, right?
Yes.
That you have an exception, and that exception needs to be dealt with. But is it enough to say, well, we're going to burn down every big city in this country for 3 months straight? You know, I don't think so. I think we still have it way better than 99% of the world. You know, I would argue that, you know, if you look at any first world country, such as European nations, Canada, Australia, right, that pretty much, you know, maybe Japan, there's a couple others, but there's not a lot of them. We have it as good as any, right? And they have their problems just like we do. You know, I mean, like in Europe, they're really having a lot of other types of problems that we don't have to deal with. So, and they are losing their freedom of speech and all kinds of issues that it's being brought up here, but it actually was touched on. I mean, you know, the last administration was actually censoring, and yes, censoring is a word that I only use when the government's involved, you know, social media and stuff like that. So when that stuff's involved, yeah, that's a start. But they have it way worse. There's a bill going through British Parliament right now to actually make it illegal to say things that would offend people. And it's got strong support. So like if I'm in a bar and I say something that maybe an offensive joke or something that offends you, even though it's not criminal, that I could be arrested for that.
Yeah, that's crazy.
Free speech means you have to listen to things that are offensive. So, you know, it's the classic, you know, example of if, you know, the Nazis or the Klan are marching downtown. I mean, we don't like it, but it's free speech. And, you know, once you start, unless they're not doing anything illegal, they're just being ignorant assholes. That's is the beauty of free speech, because once you start taking that away, it's a very fast, slippery slope.
Yeah, you don't grow unless you hear things from outside of your own echo chamber. We need
the way you combat that is you have, you know, people, you know, do the opposite, right? And explain why that's stupid. People who are intelligent explain, you know, why that's false, you know, that why that's a flawed, you know, rationale, right? And you talk it out and you learn from that, not from saying, well, they can't say that.
Yeah, and that's the thing, I think, is we're taught that it's an outside-in game, that the things outside of us are making us think and feel in a certain way. And it's actually the opposite. It's if we have anger and judgment and hatred within ourselves, those things are going to look to something outside of us to stick on, no matter what it is. No matter if you live in a first world or a third world country, it'll find people and situations to stick onto and to justify the anger and the hate we feel. And so really it's about doing the inner work. It's about going within ourselves and finding the happiness, the stillness, the peace that's inside of us, and we've just lost touch with it. And I think when we can return to the center and return to ourselves, it'll really lead to a greater understanding and appreciation of what we truly do have in places like the United States. So any closing words before we wrap up here?
No, other than if you're in the Denver Metro, Colorado area, RagnarTactical.com is my training company.
Yeah, let people know where they can find you online and get the book. Obviously.
Yeah, so I'm on the web, obviously, RagnarTactical.com. Ragnar is in the 9th century Viking who pillaged Europe. Same one who was in the Vikings, but RagnarTactical.com. I'm also on Facebook and Instagram and YouTube. And the book is The Jagged Blue Line. You can find it on Amazon. I also have an Audible, which I did myself. And you can get that either on Audible, iTunes, any of those platforms. You can also get it off Amazon. And that's pretty much it, man. That's me in a nutshell. And, you know, if people get one thing out of what we talked about today, I'd be happy.
Yeah, you know? there's so much in what we talked about. And I know this is going to be very, very valuable for people. And I want to wrap up with the final two questions, and I'll give you a chance to give your closing words. But the final two questions that we ask everybody, number one, in the spirit of this being the Supernatural Podcast, what's your definition of an extraordinary life?
Well, I do think that we put way too much emphasis on being remembered, right? Like our legacy. And quite frankly, probably after your children are gone or your grandchildren are gone, you're not going to be remembered. You didn't exist unless you, you know, for some reason, your name's on top of a building or you're part of history, right? So get over that. Yeah, for starters, and just live life for what it is. Be productive, right? Be a productive member of society and help people out, and be good at something. You don't have to be the greatest, but be good at something. But like I said, go and get your hobbies. Make use of your time. Life is precious. Don't waste it. You've only got one life to live. Don't waste it.
Yeah, very powerful. I love it. And finally, if you could share one message or one takeaway for people, for humanity as a whole at this time, what would that be?
That's a really hard one. I think we need to look at each other's perspectives. See where other people are coming from. And step outside and, like you talk about quite a bit, understand that there's a lot of puppet masters pulling the strings. And the opposition wants us to be in conflict. You've heard of divide and conquer, right? I remember guys at the police department would talk about that a lot. They'd say that, the department loves it when we had two unions. When the unions fight each other, the department loves it because it distracts them from, the things they want to do as far as cutting their pay or cutting their time off or, not giving us a raise or, not supporting us and whatever it was we were trying to get done. So it's a huge distraction. And, the people in power love distractions. So, don't let that be a part. See it for what it is. Step outside, once in a while and try to look at it from an outside perspective and think, really, what am I pissed about? What am I fighting for? What am I arguing for? Hey man, I'll tell you what's really kind of funny to me. You brought up the immigration stuff. I was talking about a guy, the guy at the gym this morning. The irony of this, people protesting ICE. Here's the irony, I think is really symbolic to me, is that you're waving a Mexican flag because you're pissed that they're deporting people to Mexico. I don't know, I just think it's funny.
Yeah, like it's so bad here that you don't want to leave. You
But you're sending them where you're waving the flag. I don't know. Is this something ironic and humorous about that to me? But
I think that's
yeah.
exactly what you're saying, though, is like I'm all for people standing for what they believe in. I'm all for free speech, and
Yeah.
but people need to step back, zoom out a little bit, and really connect the dots and see, are my belief systems coherent? Do they fit within the same framework? And
Yeah.
there's because for most people it's just impulsive, and when they take all
Right.
their beliefs, they're in conflict with one another. So I couldn't agree more. Like, take a step back, view the big picture, and be a free thinker. Think for yourself.
Absolutely. And one thing that I'm proud of myself for this is I occasionally change an opinion on something. And I mean, so many people don't, right? They're like, no, this is has to be all right, has to be all left, has to be all in the middle, whatever. I don't know, whatever it is, right? Over the last couple of years, I've completely changed my opinion on a couple of things. I've gone from one side to the other. And because I've either met somebody or talked to somebody or read a book or something where it's kind of maybe at least partially flip-flopped my opinion. And I'm proud of that. I'm open-minded enough to do that. I think that's a good thing.
Yeah, very admirable. True test of integrity, I think, is being able to admit that I changed my mind on something, and that's part of the learning process. It's part of the growth. So, I know I cut you off earlier when you said when you're talking about the one takeaway you wanted people to have. So, if there's any parting words you have for people,
I
you can
think I
toss
got it
those in.
all. I'd
Okay.
just be going over the same stuff, man.
Fantastic,
Yeah,
man.
thanks
Well,
for having me.
I want to thank you so much for coming on here, for sharing your experience and your wisdom. I think this is a conversation that people really need to hear at this time, especially with what's going on in the world. And it's something that I hope everyone can get a lot out of. So if you did enjoy this conversation, be sure to leave us a rating, leave us a review, share this conversation with a friend who needs to hear it. Thanks so much for tuning in. Thanks for being here, Graham. Great to see you,
Thanks,
and
man.
we'll be in touch soon.
Yeah, awesome. Thank you.